This is not as bad as it gets. 1. What Rusty Everett would recall later was confusion. The only image that stuck out with complete clarity was Pastor Coggin's naked upper body, fish belly, white skin, and stacked ribs. Barbie, however, perhaps because he'd been tasked by Colonel Cox to put on his investigator's hat again, saw everything. And his clearest memory wasn't of Coggins with his shirt off. It was of Melvin Searles pointing a finger at him and then tilting his head slightly. Sign language any man recognizes as meaning, "We ain't done yet, sunshine." What everyone else remembered, what brought the town situation home to them as perhaps nothing else could, were the father's cries as he held his wretched, bleeding boy in his arms, and the mother screaming.
"Is he all right, Alden? Is he all right?"
as she labored her 60 pounds overweight bulk toward the scene. Barbie saw Rusty Everett push through the circle gathering around the boy and join the two kneeling men, Alden and Lester. Alden was cradling his son in his arms as Pastor Coggin stared with his mouth sagging like a gate with a busted hinge. Rusty's wife was right behind him. Rusty fell on his knees between Alden and Lester and tried to pull the boy's hands away from his face. Alden, not surprisingly in Barbie's opinion, promptly socked him one. Rusty's nose started to bleed.
"No, let him help," the PA's wife yelled.
Linda, Barbie thought. Her name is Linda, and she's a cop.
"No, Alden, no."
Linda put her hand on the farmer's shoulder, and he turned, apparently ready to sock her. All sense had departed his face. He was an animal protecting a cub. Barbie moved forward to catch his fist, if the farmer let it fly, then had a better idea. "Medic here," he shouted, bending into Alden's face and trying to block Linda from his field of vision. "Medic, medic, med—" Barbie was yanked backward by the collar of his shirt and spun around. He had just time enough to register Mel Searles, one of Junior's buddies, and to realize that Searles was wearing a blue uniform shirt and a badge. "This is as bad as it gets," Barbie thought. But as if to prove him wrong, Searles socked him in the face, just as he had that night in Dipper's parking lot. He missed Barbie's nose, which had probably been his target, but mashed Barbie's lips back against his teeth. Searles drew back his fist to do it again, but Jackie Weddington, Mel's unwilling partner that day, grabbed his arm before he could. "Don't do it," she shouted. "Officer, don't do it." For a moment, the issue was in doubt. Then Ollie Dinsmore, closely followed by his sobbing, gasping mother, passed between them, knocking Searles back a step. Searles lowered his fist. "Okay," he said. "But you're in a crime scene, asshole. Police investigation scene. Whatever." Barbie wiped his bleeding mouth with the heel of his hand and thought, "This is not as bad as it gets. That's the hell of it. It's not." 2. The only part of this Rusty heard was Barbie shouting, "Medic." Now he said it himself. "Medic, Mr. Dinsmore, Rusty Everett, you know me. Let me look at your boy."
"Let him, Alden," Shelley cried. "Let him take care of Rory."
Alden relaxed his grip on the kid, who was swaying back and forth on his knees, his blue jeans soaked with blood. Rory had covered his face with his hands again. Rusty took hold of them, gently, gently does it, and pulled them down. He had hoped it wouldn't be as bad as he feared, but the socket was raw and empty, pouring blood, and the brain behind that socket was hurt plenty. The news was in how the remaining eye cocked senselessly skyward, bulging at nothing. Rusty started to pull his shirt off, but the preacher was already holding out his own. Coggin's upper body, thin and white in front, striped with crisscrossing red welts in back, was running with sweat. He held the shirt out. "No," Rusty said. "Rip it, rip it." For a moment, Lester didn't get it. Then he tore the shirt down the middle. The rest of the police contingent was arriving now, and some of the regular cops, Henry Morrison, George Frederick, Jackie Weddington, Freddie Denton, were yelling at the new special deputies to help move the crowd back, make some space. The new hires did so, and enthusiastically. Some of the rubberneckers were knocked down, including that famous Bratz torturer, Samantha Bushy. Sammy had little Walter in a papoose carrier, and when she went on her ass, both of them began to squall. Junior Rennie stepped over her without so much as a look and grabbed Rory's mom, almost pulling the wounded boy's mother off her feet before Freddie Denton stopped him.
No, Junior, no. It's the kid's mother. Let her loose.
Police brutality,
Sammy Bushy yelled from where she lay in the grass.
Police brutal...
Georgia Rue, the newest hire in what had become Peter Randolph's police department, arrived with Carter Thibodeau, holding his hand, actually. Georgia pressed her boot against one of Sammy's breasts, it wasn't quite a kick, and said,
Yo, Dyke, shut up.
Junior let go of Rory's mother and went to stand with Mel, Carter, and Georgia. They were staring at Barbie. Junior added his eyes to theirs, thinking that the cook was like a bad goddamn penny that kept turning up. He thought Barbie would look awfully good in a cell right next to Sloppy Sam's. Junior also thought that being a cop had been his destiny all along. It had certainly helped with his headaches. Rusty took half of Lester's torn shirt and ripped it again. He folded a piece, started to put it over the gaping wound in the boy's face, then changed his mind and gave it to the father. Hold it to the... The words barely came out. His throat was full of blood from his mashed nose. Rusty hawked it back, turned his head, spat a half-clotted loogie into the grass, and tried again. Hold it to the wound, Dad. Apply pressure. Hand to the back of his neck and squeeze. Dazed but willing, Alden Dinsmore did as he was told. The makeshift pad immediately turned red, but the man seemed calmer nonetheless. Having something to do helped. It usually did. Rusty flung the remaining piece of shirt at Lester. More, he said, and Lester began ripping the shirt into smaller pieces. Rusty lifted Dinsmore's hand and removed the first pad, which was now soaked and useless. Shelley Dinsmore shrieked when she saw the empty socket.
Oh, my boy! My boy!
Peter Randolph arrived at a jog, huffing and puffing. Still, he was far ahead of Big Jim, who, mindful of his substandard ticker, was plodding down the slope of the field on grass the rest of the crowd had trampled into a broad path. He was thinking of what a cluster mug this had turned out to be. Town gatherings would have to be by permit only in the future, and if he had anything to do with it, he would. He always did. Permits would be hard to come by.
Move these people back further,
Randolph snarled at Officer Morrison, and as Henry turned to do so, move it back, folks! Give him some air. Morrison bawled, Officers form a line, push him back. Anyone who resists, put him in cuffs. The crowd began a slow reverse shuffle. Barbie lingered. Mr. Everett, Rusty, do you need any help? Are you okay? Fine, Rusty said, and his face told Barbie everything he needed to know. The PA was all right, just a bloody nose. The kid wasn't, and never would be again. Even if he lived. Rusty applied a fresh pad to the kid's bleeding eye socket and put the father's hand over it again. Nape of the neck, he said. Press hard. Hard. Barbie started to step back, but then the kid spoke. 3.
It's Halloween. You can't... We can't...
Rusty froze in the act of folding another piece of shirt into a compression pad. Suddenly he was back in his daughter's bedroom listening to Janelle scream, It's the Great Pumpkin's fault. He looked up at Linda. She had heard too. Her eyes were big, the color fleeing her previously flushed cheeks.
Linda, Rusty snapped at her, get on your walkie, call the hospital, tell Twitch to get the ambulance.
The fire!
Rory Dinsmore screamed in a high, trembling voice. Lester was staring at him as Moses might have stared at the burning bush.
The fire. The bus is in the fire. Everyone's screaming. Watch out for Halloween.
The crowd was silent now, listening to the child rant. Even Jim Rennie heard as he reached the back of the mob and began to elbow his way through.
Linda, Rusty shouted, get on your walkie. We need the ambulance.
She started visibly, as if someone had just clapped his hands in front of her face. She pulled the walkie-talkie off her belt. Rory tumbled forward into the flattened grass and began to seize.
What's happening?
That was the father.
Oh, dear, to Jesus, he's dying.
That was the mother. Rusty turned the trembling, bucking child over, trying not to think of Janny as he did it, but that, of course, was impossible. And tilting his chin up to create an airway. Come on, Dad, he told Alden. Don't quit on me now. Squeeze the neck. Compression on the wound. Let's stop the bleeding. Compression might drive the fragment that had taken the kid's eye deeper in, but Rusty would worry about that later. If that was the kid didn't die right out here on the grass. From nearby, but oh, so far. One of the soldiers finally spoke up. Barely out of his teens, he looked terrified and sorry. We tried to stop him. Boy didn't listen. There wasn't nothing we could do. Pete Freeman, his Nikon dangling by his knee on its strap, favored this young warrior with a smile of singular bitterness. I think we know that. If we didn't before, we sure do now. 4. Before Barbie could melt into the crowd, Mel Searles grabbed him by the arm. Take your hand off me, Barbie said mildly. Searles showed his teeth in a version of a grin. In your dreams, fucko. Then he raised his voice. Chief! Hey, Chief! Peter Randolph turned toward him impatiently, frowning.
This guy interfered with me while I was trying to secure the scene. Can I arrest him?
Randolph opened his mouth, possibly to say, don't waste my time. Then he looked around. Jim Rennie had finally joined the little group watching Everett work on the boy. Rennie gave Barbie the flat stare of a reptile on a rock, then looked back at Randolph and nodded slightly. Mel saw it. His grin widened.
Jackie, Officer Weddington, I mean. Can I borrow a pair of your cuffs?
Junior and the rest of his crew were also grinning. This was better than watching some bleeding kid, and a lot better than policing a bunch of holy rollers and dumbbells with signs.
Payback's a bitch, Barbie, Junior said.
Jackie looked dubious.
Pete, Chief, I mean, I think the guy was only trying to
Cuff him up, Randolph said. We'll sort out what he was or wasn't trying to do later. In the meantime, I want this mess shut down.
He raised his voice.
It's over, folks. You've had your fun, and see what it's come to. Now go home.
Jackie was removing a set of plastic cuffs from her belt. She had no intention of handing them to Mel Searles, would put them on herself. When Julia Shumway spoke up, she was standing just behind Randolph and Big Jim. In fact, Big Jim had elbowed her aside on his way to where the action was.
I wouldn't do that, Chief Randolph, unless you want the PD embarrassed on the front page of the Democrat.
She was smiling her Mona Lisa smile.
With you so new to the job and all.
What are you talking about?
Randolph asked. His frown was deeper now, turning his face into a series of unlovely crevices. Julia held up her camera, a slightly older version of Pete Freeman's.
I have quite a few pictures of Mr. Barbara assisting Rusty Everett with that wounded child, a couple of Officer Searles hauling Mr. Barbara off for no discernible reason, and one of Officer Searles punching Mr. Barbara in the mouth, also for no discernible reason. I'm not much of a photographer, but that one is really quite good. Would you like to see it, Chief Randolph? You can. The camera's digital.
Barbie's admiration for her deepened because he thought she was running a bluff. If she'd been taking pictures, why was she holding the lens cap in her left hand, as if she'd just taken it off?
It's a lie, Chief, Mel said. He tried to take a swing at me. Ask Junior.
I think my pictures will show that young Mr. Rennie was involved in crowd control and had his back turned when the punch landed, Julia said.
Randolph was glowering at her. I could take your camera away, he said. Evidence.
You certainly could, she agreed cheerily, and Pete Freeman would take a picture of you doing it. Then you could take Pete's camera, but everyone here would see you do it.
Whose side are you on here, Julia? Big Jim asked.
He was smiling his fierce smile, the smile of a shark about to take a bite out of some plump swimmer's ass. Julia turned her own smile on him, the eyes above it as innocent and inquiring as a child's.
Are there sides, James? Other than over there, she pointed at the watching soldiers, and in here.
Big Jim considered her, his lips now bending the other way, a smile in reverse. Then he flapped one disgusted hand at Randolph. I guess we'll let it slide, Mr. Barbara, Randolph said. Heat of the moment.
Thanks, Barbie said.
Jackie took her glowering young partner's arm. Come on, Officer Searles. This part's over. Let's move these people back.
Searles went with her, but not before turning to Barbie and making the gesture. Finger pointing, head cocked slightly. We ain't done yet, sunshine.
Romy's assistant, Toby Manning, and Jack Evans appeared, carrying a makeshift stretcher made out of canvas and tent poles. Romy opened his mouth to ask what the hell they thought they were doing, then closed it again. The field day had been canceled anyway, so what the hell.
5. Those with cars got into them. Then they all tried to drive away at the same time.
Predictable, Joe McClatchy thought. Totally predictable.
Most of the cops worked to unclog the resulting traffic jam, although even a bunch of kids, Joe was standing with Benny Drake and Nori Calvert, could tell that the new and improved 5-0 had no idea what it was doing. The sound of popo curses came clear on the summery air.
Can't you back that son of a whore up?
In spite of the mess, nobody seemed to be laying on their horns. Most folks were probably too bummed to beep.
Benny said, look at those idiots. How many gallons of gas do you think they're blowing out their tailpipes? Like, they think the supply's endless.
Word,
Nori said.
She is a tough kid, a small-town riot girl with a modified Tennessee top hat mullet do. But now she only looked pale and sad and scared.
She took Benny's hand. Scarecrow Joe's heart broke, then remended itself in an instant when she took his as well.
There goes the guy who almost got arrested, Benny said, pointing with his free hand.
Barbie and the newspaper lady were trudging across the field toward the makeshift parking lot with 60 or 80 other people, some dragging their protest signs dispiritedly behind them.
Nancy newspaper wasn't taking pictures at all, you know, Scarecrow Joe said. I was standing right behind her. Pretty foxy.
Yeah, Benny said, but I still wouldn't want to be him. Till this shit ends, the cops can do pretty much what they want.
That was true, Joe reflected. And the new cops weren't particularly nice guys. Junior Rennie, for example. The story of Sloppy Sam's arrest was already making the rounds.
What are you saying?
Nori asked Benny.
Nothing right now. It's still cool right now, he considered. Fairly cool. But if this goes on, remember Lord of the Flies?
They had read it for Honors English. Benny intoned,
kill the pig, cut her throat, bash her in. People call cops pigs, but I'll tell you what I think. I think cops find pigs when the shit gets deep. Maybe because they get scared too.
Nori Calvert burst into tears. Scarecrow Joe put an arm around her. He did it carefully, as if he thought doing such a thing might cause them both to explode. But she turned her face against his shirt and hugged him. It was a one-armed hug, because she was still holding on to Benny with her other hand. Joe thought he had felt nothing in his whole life as weirdly thrilling as her tears dampening his shirt. Over the top of her head, he looked at Benny reproachfully.
Sorry, dude, Benny said, and patted her back. No fear.
His eye was gone, she cried.
The words were muffled against Joe's chest. Then she let go of him.
This isn't fun anymore. This is not fun.
No.
Joe spoke as if discovering a great truth.
It isn't. Look,
Benny said. It was the ambulance. Twitch was bumping across Dinsmore's field with the red roof lights flashing. His sister, the woman who owned Sweetbriar Rose, was walking ahead of him, guiding him around the worst potholes. An ambulance in a hayfield, under a bright afternoon sky in October. It was the final touch. Suddenly, Scarecrow Joe no longer wanted to protest. Nor did he exactly want to go home. At that moment, the only thing in the world he wanted was to get out of town.
6.
Julia slid behind the wheel of her car but didn't start it. They were going to be here a while, and there was no sense in wasting gas. She leaned past Barbie, opened the glove compartment, and brought out an old pack of American Spirits.
Emergency supplies, she told him apologetically. Do you want one?
He shook his head.
Do you mind, because I can wait?
He shook his head again. She lit up, then blew smoke out her open window. It was still warm, a real Indian summer day for sure, but it wouldn't stay that way. Another week or so and the weather would turn wrong, as the old-timer said. Or maybe not, she thought. Who in the hell knows? If the dome stayed in place, she had no doubt that plenty of meteorologists would weigh in on the subject of the weather inside, but so what? The Weather Channel Yodas couldn't even predict which way a snowstorm would turn. And in Julia's opinion, they deserve no more credence than the political geniuses who blabbed their days away at the Sweetbriar Rose bullshit table.
Thanks for speaking up back there, he said. You saved my bacon.
Here's a newsflash, honey. Your bacon's still hanging in the smokehouse. What are you going to do next time? Have your friend Cox call the ACLU? They might be interested, but I don't think anyone from the Portland office is going to be visiting Chester's Mill soon.
Don't be so pessimistic. The dome might blow out to sea tonight, or just dissipate. We don't know.
Fat chance. This is a government job, some governments, and I'll bet your Colonel Cox knows it.
Barbie was silent.
He had believed Cox when Cox said the U.S. hadn't been responsible for the dome. Not because Cox was necessarily trustworthy, but because Barbie just didn't think America had the technology. Or any other country, for that matter. But what did he know? His last service job had been threatening scared Iraqis, sometimes with a gun to their heads.
Junior's friend Frankie DeLesseps was out on Route 119 helping to direct traffic. He was wearing a blue uniform shirt over jeans. There probably hadn't been any uniform pants in his size at the station. He was a tall son of a bitch. And, Julia saw with misgivings, he was wearing a gun on his hip. Smaller than the Glocks the regular mill police carried. Probably his own property. But it was a gun, all right.
What will you do if the Hitler Youth comes after you? She asked, lifting her chin in Frankie's direction. Good luck hollering police brutality if they jug you and decide to finish what they started. There's only two lawyers in town, one senile and the other drives a Boxster Jim Rennie got him at discount. Or so I've heard.
I can take care of myself.
Ooh, macho.
What's up with your paper? It looked ready when I left last night.
Technically speaking, you left this morning, and yes, it's ready. Pete and I and a few friends will make sure it gets distributed. I just didn't see any point in starting while the town was three quarters empty. Want to be a volunteer newsboy?
I would, but I've got a zillion sandwiches to make. Strictly cold food at the restaurant tonight.
Maybe I'll drop by. She tossed her cigarette, only half-smoked, from the window.
Then, after a moment's consideration, she got out and stepped on it. Starting a grass fire out here would not be cool. Not with the town's new fire truck stranded in Castle Rock.
I swung by Chief Perkins' house earlier, she said as she got back behind the wheel. Except, of course, it's just Brenda's now.
How is she?
Terrible. But when I said you wanted to see her and that it was important, although I didn't say what it was about, she agreed. After dark might be best. I suppose your friend will be impatient.
Stop calling Cox my friend. He is not my friend.
They watched silently as the wounded boy was loaded into the back of the ambulance. The soldiers were still watching, too. Probably against orders. And that made Julia feel a little better about them. The ambulance began to buck its way back across the field, lights flashing.
This is terrible, she said, in a thin voice.
Barbie put an arm around her shoulders. She tensed for a moment, then relaxed, looking straight ahead at the ambulance, which was now turning into a cleared lane in the middle of Route 119, she said,
What if they shut me down, my friend? What if Rennie and his pet police decide to shut my little newspaper down?
That's not going to happen, Barbie said. But he wondered. If this went on long enough, he supposed every day in Chester's Mill would become Anything Can Happen Day.
She had something else in her mind, Julia Shumway said.
Mrs. Perkins?
Yes, it was in many ways a very strange conversation.
She's grieving for her husband, Barbie said. Grief makes people strange. I said hello to Jack Evans. His wife died yesterday when the dome came down, and he looked at me as if he didn't know me, although I've been serving him my famous Wednesday meatloaf since last spring.
I've known Brenda Perkins since she was Brenda Morse, Julia said. Almost 40 years. I thought she might tell me what was troubling her, but she didn't.
Barbie pointed at the road. I think you can go now. As Julia started the engine, her cell phone trilled. She almost dropped her bag in her hurry to dig it out. She listened, then handed it to Barbie with her ironic smile. It's for you, boss. It was Cox, and Cox had something to say, quite a lot, actually. Barbie interrupted long enough to tell Cox what had happened to the boy, now headed to Kathy Russell. But Cox either didn't relate Rory Dinsmore's story to what he was saying, or didn't want to. He listened politely enough, then went on. When he finished, he asked Barbie a question that would have been in order had Barbie still been in uniform and under his command. Sir, I understand what you're asking, but you don't understand that... I guess you'd call it the political situation here, and my little part in it. I had some trouble before this dumb thing, and...
We all know about that, Cox said. An altercation with the second selectman's son and some of his friends. You were almost arrested, according to what I've got in my folder.
A folder? Now he's got a folder. God help me.
That's fine intel as far as it goes, Barbie said, but let me give you a little more. One, the police chief who kept me from being arrested died out on 119, not far from where I'm talking to you, in fact. Faintly, in a world he could not now visit, Barbie heard paper rattle. He suddenly felt he would like to kill Colonel James O. Cox with his bare hands, simply because Colonel James O. Cox could go out for Mickey D's anytime he wanted, and he, Dale Barbara, could not.
We know about that, too, Cox said. A pacemaker problem.
Two, Barbie went on, the new chief, who is asshole buddies with the only powerful member of this town's board of selectmen, has hired some new deputies. They're the guys who tried to beat my head off my shoulders in the parking lot of the local nightclub.
Oh, you'll have to rise above that, won't you, Colonel?
Why are you calling me Colonel? You're the Colonel.
Congratulations, Cox said. Not only have you re-enlisted in your country's service, you've gotten an absolutely dizzying promotion.
No, Barbie shouted. Julia was looking at him with concern, but he was hardly aware of it.
No, I don't want it.
Yeah, but you've got it, Cox said calmly. I'm going to email a copy of the essential paperwork to your editor, friend, before we shut down your unfortunate little town's internet capacity.
Shut it down? You can't shut it down.
The paperwork is signed by the president himself. You going to say no to him? I understand he can be a tad grumpy when he's crossed. Barbie didn't reply. His mind was whirling.
You need to visit the selectmen and the police chief, Cox said. You need to tell them the president has invoked martial law in Chester's Mill, and you're the officer in charge. I'm sure you'll encounter some initial resistance, but the information I've just given you should help establish you as the town's conduit to the outside world. And I know your powers of persuasion. Saw them firsthand in Iraq.
Sir, he said, you have so misread the situation here. He ran a hand through his hair. His ear was throbbing from the goddamn cell phone.
It's as if you can comprehend the idea of the dome, but not what's happening in this town as a result of it. And it's been less than 30 hours.
Help me understand, then. You say the president wants me to do this. Suppose I were to call him up and tell him he can kiss my rosy red ass.
Julia was looking at him horrified, and this actually inspired him.
Suppose, in fact, I said I was a sleeper Al-Qaeda agent, and I was planning to kill him. Pow, one to the head. How about that?
Lieutenant Barbara, Colonel Barbara, I mean, you've said enough.
Barbie did not feel this was so. Could he send the FBI to come and grab me? The Secret Service? The goddamn Red Army? No, sir, he could not.
We have plans to change that, as I have just explained.
Cox no longer sounded loose and good-humored, just one old grunt talking to another.
And if it works, feel free to have the federal agency of your choice come and arrest me, but if we stay cut off, who in here's going to listen to me? Get it through your head. This town has seceded. Not just from America, but from the whole world. There's nothing we can do about it, and nothing you can do about it either. Quietly, Cox said,
We're trying to help you guys.
You say that, and I almost believe you. Will anybody else around here? When they look to see what kind of help their taxes are buying them, they see soldiers standing guard with their backs turned. That sends a hell of a message.
You're talking a whole lot for someone who's saying no.
I'm not saying no, but I'm only about 9 feet from being arrested, and proclaiming myself the Commandant Pro Tem won't help.
Suppose I were to call the first selectman, what's his name, Sanders, and tell him.
That's what I mean by how little you know. It's like Iraq all over again, only this time you're in Washington instead of boots on the ground, and you seem as clueless as the rest of the desk soldiers. Read my lips, sir. Some intelligence is worse than no intelligence at all.
A little learning is a dangerous thing, Julia said dreamily.
If not Sanders, then who?
James Rennie, the second selectman. He's the boss hog around here.
There was a pause.
Then Cox said, maybe we can give you the internet. Some of us are of the opinion that cutting it off's just a knee-jerk reaction anyway.
Why would you think that? Barbie asked. Don't you guys know that if you let us stay on the net, Aunt Sarah's cranberry bread recipe is sure to get out sooner or later?
Julia sat up straight and mouthed, they're trying to cut the internet?
Barbie raised one finger toward her.
Wait. Just hear me out, Barbie. Suppose we call this Rennie and tell him the internet's got to go. So sorry, crisis situation, extreme measures, etc., etc. Then you can convince him of your usefulness by changing our minds.
Barbie considered. It might work, for a while, anyway. Or it might not.
Plus, Cox said brightly, you'll be giving them this other information. Maybe saving some lives. But saving people the scare of their lives, for sure.
Barbie said, phones stay up as well as internet.
That's hard. I might be able to keep the net for you, but listen, man, there are at least 5 Curtis LeMay types sitting on the committee presiding over this mess. And as far as they're concerned, everyone in Chester's Mill is a terrorist until proved otherwise.
What can these hypothetical terrorists do to harm America? Suicide bomb the Congo church?
Barbie, you're preaching to the choir.
Of course, that was probably the truth.
Will you do it?
I'll have to get back to you on that. Wait for my call before you do anything. I have to talk to the late police chief's widow first.
Cox persisted.
Will you keep the horse trading part of this conversation to yourself?
Again, Barbie was struck by how little even Cox, a free thinker by military standards, understood about the changes the dome had already wrought. And here, the Cox brand of secrecy no longer mattered.
Us against them, Barbie thought. Now it's us against them. Unless their crazy idea works, that is.
Sir, I really will have to get back to you on that. This phone is suffering a bad case of low battery.
A lie, he told with no remorse.
And you need to wait to hear from me before you talk to anybody else.
Just remember, the Big Bang's scheduled for 1300 tomorrow. If you want to maintain viability on this, you better stay out front.
Maintain viability, another meaningless phrase under the dome. Unless it applied to keeping your Jenny supplied with propane. We'll talk, Barbie said. He closed the phone before Cox could say more. 119 was almost clear now, although De Lesseps was still there, leaning against his vintage muscle car with his arms folded. As Julia drove past the Nova, Barbie noted a sticker reading, Ass, Gas, or Grass. Nobody rides for free. Also a police bubblegum light on the dash. He thought the contrast summed up everything that was now wrong in Chester's Mill. As they rode, Barbie told her everything Cox had said.
What they're planning is really no different than what that kid just tried, she said, sounding appalled.
Well, a little different, Barbie said. The kid tried it with a rifle. They've got a cruise missile lined up.
Call it the Big Bang Theory. She smiled. It wasn't her usual one. Wan and bewildered. It made her look 60 instead of 43.
I think I'm going to be putting out another paper sooner than I thought.
Barbie nodded.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
7.
Hello, Sammy, someone said. How are you?
Samantha Bushy didn't recognize the voice and turned toward it warily, hitching up the papoose carrier as she did. Little Walter was asleep and he weighed a ton. Her butt hurt from falling on it. And her feelings were hurt, too, that damn Georgia Rue calling her a dyke. Georgia Rue, who had come whining around Sammy's trailer more than once, looking to score an 8-ball for her and the muscle-bound freak she went around with. It was Dodie's father. Sammy had spoken with him thousands of times, but she hadn't recognized his voice. She hardly recognized him. He looked old and sad, broken somehow. He didn't even scope out her boobs, which was a first.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. Gee, I didn't even see you at the...
She flapped her hand back toward the flattened-down field in the big tent. now half collapsed and looking forlorn, although not as forlorn as Mr. Sanders.
I was sitting in the shade.
That same hesitant voice, coming through an apologetic, hurting smile that was hard to look at.
I had something to drink, though. Wasn't it warm for October? Golly, yes. I thought it was a good afternoon, a real town afternoon, until that boy...
Oh, Crispy Crackers, he was crying.
I'm awful sorry about your wife, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Sammy, that's very kind. Can I carry your baby back to your car for you? I think you can go now. The road's almost clear.
That was an offer Sammy couldn't refuse, even if he was crying. She scooped little Walter out of the papoose. It was like picking up a big clump of warm bread dough, and handed him over. Little Walter opened his eyes, smiled glassily, belched, then went back to sleep.
I think he might have a package in his diaper, Mr. Sanders said.
Yeah, he's a regular shit machine. Good old little Walter.
Walter's a very nice old-fashioned name.
Thanks.
Telling him that her baby's first name was actually Little didn't seem worth the trouble. And she was sure she'd had that conversation with him before anyway. He just didn't remember. Walking with him like this, even though he was carrying the baby, was the perfect bummer end to a perfect bummer afternoon. At least he was right about the traffic. The automotive mosh pit had finally cleared out. Sammy wondered how long it would be before the whole town was riding bicycles again.
I never liked the idea of her in that plane, Mr. Sanders said.
He seemed to be picking up the thread of some interior conversation.
Sometimes I even wondered if Claudie was sleeping with that guy.
Dodie's mom sleeping with Chuck Thompson? Sammy was both shocked and intrigued.
Probably not, he said, and sighed. In any case, it doesn't matter now. Have you seen Dodie? She didn't come home last night.
Sammy almost said sure yesterday afternoon. But if the Dodster hadn't slept at home last night, saying that would only worry the Dodster's dadster. And let Sammy in for a long conversation with a guy who had tears streaming down his face and a snot runner hanging from one nostril. That would not be cool. They had reached her car, an old Chevrolet with cancer of the rocker panels. She took little Walter and grimaced at the smell. That wasn't just mail in his diaper, that was UPS and Federal Express combined.
No, Mr. Sanders, haven't seen her.
He nodded, then wiped his nose with the back of his hand. The snot runner disappeared, or at least it went somewhere else. That was a relief.
She probably went to the mall with Angie McCain, then to her Aunt Peg's in Sabattis when she couldn't get back into town.
Yeah, that's probably it.
And when Dodie turned up right here in the mill, he'd have a pleasant surprise. God knew he deserved one. Sammy opened the car door and laid little Walter on the passenger side. She'd given up on the child restraint seat months ago, too much of a pain in the ass, and besides, she was a very safe driver.
Good to see you, Sammy. A pause. Will you pray for my wife?
Sure, Mr. Sanders, no prob.
She started to get in the car, then remembered two things. That Georgia Rue had shoved her tit with her goddamn motorcycle boot, probably hard enough to leave a bruise. And that Andy Sanders, brokenhearted or not, was the town's first selectman.
Mr. Sanders?
Yes, Sammy?
Some of those cops were kind of rough out there. You might want to do something about that before it, you know, gets out of hand.
His unhappy smile didn't change.
Well, Sammy, I understand how you young people feel about police. I was young myself once, but we've got a pretty bad situation here. And the quicker we establish a little authority, the better off everyone will be. You understand that, don't you?
Sure, Sammy said.
What she understood was that grief, no matter how genuine, did not seem to impede a politician's flow of bullshit.
Well, I'll see you.
They're a good team, Andy said vaguely. Pete Randolph will see they all pull together, wear the same hat, do the same dance. Protect and serve, you know.
Sure,
Samantha said. The protect and serve dance, with the occasional tit kick thrown in. She pulled away with little Walter once more snoring on the seat. The smell of baby shit was terrific. She unrolled the windows, then looked in the rearview mirror. Mr. Sanders was still standing in the makeshift parking lot, which was now almost entirely deserted. He raised a hand to her. Sammy raised her own in turn, wondering just where Dodie had stayed last night if she hadn't gone home. Then she dismissed it. It was really none of her concern, and flipped on the radio. The only thing she could get clearly was Jesus radio, and she turned it off again. When she looked up, Frankie De Lesseps was standing in the road in front of her with his hand up, just like a real cop. She had to stop the brake to keep from hitting him, then put her hand on the baby to keep him from falling. Little Walter awoke and began to blat.
"Look what you did,"
she yelled at Frankie, with whom she'd once had a two-day fling back in high school when Angie was at band camp.
"The baby almost went on the floor."
"Where's his seat?" Frankie leaned in her window, biceps bulging. Big muscles, little dick. That was Frankie De Lesseps. As far as Sammy was concerned, Angie could have him.
"None of your beeswax."
A real cop might have written her up for the lip as much as the child restraint law, but Frankie only smirked. "You seen Angie?"
"No." This time it was the truth. "She probably got caught out of town."
Although it seemed to Sammy that the ones in town were the ones who'd gotten caught. "What about Dodie?" Sammy once again said no. She practically had to because Frankie might talk to Mr. Sanders. "Angie's car's at her house," Frankie said. "I looked in the garage."
"Big whoop, they probably went off somewhere in Dodie's Kia."
He seemed to consider this. They were almost alone now. The traffic jam was just a memory. Then he said, "Did Georgia hurt your boobie, baby?" And before she could answer, he reached in and grabbed it. Not gently, either. "Want me to kiss it all better?" She slapped his hand. On her right, little Walter blatted and blatted. Sometimes she wondered why God had made men in the first place. She really did. Always blatting or grabbing, grabbing or blatting. Frankie wasn't smiling now.
"You want to watch that shit?" he said.
"Things are different now."
"What are you going to do, arrest me?"
"I think of something better than that," he said. "Go on, get out of here, and if you do see Angie, tell her I want to see her." She drove away mad, and she didn't like to admit this to herself, but it was true. A little frightened. Half a mile down the road, she pulled over and changed little Walter's diaper. There was a used diaper bag in back, but she was too mad to bother. She threw the shitty pamper onto the shoulder of the road instead, not far from the big sign reading, "Jim Rennie's Used Cars. Foreign and domestic. Ask us for credit. You'll be wheeling because Big Jim is dealing." She passed some kids on bikes and wondered again how long it would be before everyone was riding them. Except it wouldn't come to that. Someone would figure things out before it did. Just like in one of those disaster movies she enjoyed watching on TV while she was stoned. Volcanoes erupting in L.A., zombies in New York. And when things went back to normal, Frankie and Carter Thibodeau would revert to what they'd been before. Small-town losers with little or no jingle in their pockets. In the meantime, though, she might do well to keep a low profile. All in all, she was glad she kept her mouth shut about Dodie. 8. Rusty listened to the blood pressure monitor begin its urgent beeping and knew they were losing the boy. Actually, they'd been losing him ever since the ambulance. Hell, from the moment the ricochet struck him. But the sound of the monitor turned the truth into a headline. Rory should have been life-flighted to CMG immediately, right from where he'd been so grievously wounded. Instead, he was in an under-equipped operating room that was too warm. The air conditioning had been turned off to conserve the generator. Being operated on by a doctor who should have retired years ago, a physician's assistant who had never assisted in a neurosurgery case, and a single exhausted nurse who spoke up now.
"V-fib, Dr. Haskell."
The heart monitor had joined in. Now it was a chorus.
"I know, Ginny, I'm not deaf."
He paused.
"Deaf. I mean, Christ."
For a moment, he and Rusty looked at each other over the boy's sheet-swaddled form. Haskell's eyes were clear, and with it, this was not the same stethoscope-equipped time server who had been plodding through the rooms and corridors of Kathy Russell for the last couple of years like a dull ghost. But he looked terribly old and frail.
"We tried," Rusty said.
In truth, Haskell had done more than try. He'd reminded Rusty of one of those sports novels he'd loved as a kid, where the aging pitcher comes out of the bullpen for one more shot at glory in the seventh game of the World Series. But only Rusty and Jenny Tomlinson had been in the stands for this performance. And this time, there would be no happy ending for the old warhorse. Rusty had started the saline drip, adding mannitol to reduce brain swelling. Haskell had left the OR at an actual run to do the blood work in the lab down the hall. A complete CBC. It had to be Haskell. Rusty was unqualified and there were no lab techs. Catherine Russell was now hideously understaffed. Rusty thought the Dinsmore boy might be only a down payment on the price the town would eventually have to pay for that lack of personnel. It got worse. The boy was A negative, and they had none in their small blood supply. They did, however, have O negative, the universal donor, and had given Rory 4 units, which left exactly 9 more in supply. Giving it to the boy had probably been tantamount to pouring it down the scrubroom drain, but none of them had said so. While the blood ran into him, Haskell sent Ginny down to the closet-sized cubicle that served as the hospital's library. She came back with a tattered copy of On Neurosurgery, a brief overview. Haskell operated with the book beside him, an otoscope laid across the pages to hold them down. Rusty thought he would never forget the whine of the saw, the smell of the bone dust in the unnaturally warm air, or the clot of jellied blood that oozed out after Haskell removed the bone plug. For a few minutes, Rusty had actually allowed himself to hope. With the pressure of the hematoma relieved by the burr hole, Rory's vital signs had stabilized, or tried to. Then, while Haskell was attempting to determine if the bullet fragment was within his reach, everything had started going downhill again, and fast. Rusty thought of the parents waiting and hoping against hope. Now, instead of wheeling Rory to the left outside the OR, toward Kathy Russell's ICU, where his folks might be allowed to creep in and see him, it looked like Rory would be taking a right, toward the morgue.
If this were an ordinary situation, I'd maintain life support and ask the parents about organ donation, Haskell said. But of course, if this were an ordinary situation, he wouldn't be here. And even if he was, I wouldn't be trying to operate on him using a goddamn Toyota manual.
He picked up the otoscope and threw it across the OR. It struck the green tiles, chipped one, and fell to the floor.
Do you want to administer epi, Doctor? Ginny asked.
Calm, cool, and collected, but she looked tired enough to drop in her tracks.
Was I not clear? I won't prolong this boy's agony.
Haskell reached toward the red switch on the back of the respirator. Some wit, twitch perhaps, had put a small sticker there that read, Booyah.
Do you want to express a contrary opinion, Rusty?
Rusty considered the question, then slowly shook his head. The Babinski test had been positive, indicating major brain damage. But the main thing was that there was just no chance. Never had been, really. Haskell flipped the switch. Rory Dinsmore took one labored breath on his own, appeared to try for a second one, and then gave up.
I make it. Haskell looked at the big clock on the wall. 5:15 p.m. Will you note that as the TOD, Ginny?
Yes, Doctor.
Haskell pulled down his mask, and Rusty noted with concern that the old man's lips were blue.
Let's get out of here, he said. The heat is killing me.
But it wasn't the heat. His heart was doing that. He collapsed halfway down the corridor on his way to give Alden and Shelley Dinsmore the bad news. Rusty got to administer epi after all, but it did no good. Neither did closed chest massage. Or the paddles. Time of death? 5:49 p.m. Ron Haskell outlived his last patient by exactly 34 minutes. Rusty sat down on the floor, his back against the wall. Ginny had given Rory's parents the news. From where he sat with his face in his hands, Rusty could hear the mother's shrieks of grief and sorrow. They carried well in the nearly empty hospital. She sounded as if she would never stop.
9.
Barbie thought that the chief's widow must once have been an extremely beautiful woman. Even now, with dark circles under her eyes and an indifferent choice of clothes, faded jeans, and what he was pretty sure was a pajama top, Brenda Perkins was striking. He thought, maybe smart people rarely lost their good looks. If they had good ones to begin with, that was. And he saw the clear light of intelligence in her eyes. Something else, too. She might be in mourning, but it hadn't killed her curiosity. And right now the object of her curiosity was him. She looked over his shoulder at Julia's car backing down the driveway and raised her hands to it.
Where are you going?
Julia leaned out the window and called. I have to make sure the paper gets out. I also have to go by Sweetbriar Rose and give Anson Wheeler the bad news. He's on sandwich detail tonight. Don't worry, Bren. Barbie's safe. And before Brenda could reply or remonstrate, Julia was off down Morin Street, a woman on a mission. Barbie wished he were with her, his only objective the creation of 40 ham and cheese and 40 tuna sandwiches. With Julia gone, Brenda resumed her inspection. They were on opposite sides of the screen door. Barbie felt like a job applicant facing a tough interview.
Are you? Brenda asked.
Beg your pardon, ma'am?
Are you safe?
Barbie considered it. 2 days ago, he would have said yes. Of course he was. But on this afternoon, he felt more like the soldier of Fallujah than the cook of Chester's Mill. He settled for saying he was housebroken, which made her smile.
Well, I'll have to make my own judgment on that, she said, even though right now my judgment isn't the best. I've suffered a loss.
I know, ma'am. I'm very sorry.
Thank you. He's being buried tomorrow. Out of that cheesy little Bowie funeral home that continues to stagger along somehow, even though almost everyone in town uses Crosman's in Castle Rock. Folks call Stuart Bowie's establishment Bowie's Burying Barn. Stuart's an idiot and his brother Fernald's worse. But now they're all we have. All I have.
She sighed like a woman confronting some vast chore. And why not, Barbie thought. The death of a loved one may be many things, but work is certainly one of them. She surprised him by stepping out onto the stoop with him.
Walk round back with me, Mr. Barbara. I may invite you in later on, but not until I'm sure of you. Ordinarily, I'd take a character reference from Julia like a shot, but these are not ordinary times.
She was leading him along the side of the house over nicely clipped grass raked clear of autumn leaves. On the right was a board fence separating the Perkins home from its next-door neighbor, and on the left were nicely kept flower beds.
The flowers were my husband's bailiwick. I suppose you think that's a strange hobby for a law enforcement officer.
Actually, I don't.
I never did either, which makes us in the minority. Small towns harbor small imaginations. Grace Metallius and Sherwood Anderson were right about that. Also, she said as they rounded the rear corner of the house and entered a commodious backyard, it will stay light out here longer. I have a generator, but it died this morning, out of fuel, I believe. There's a spare tank, but I don't know how to change it. I used to nag Howie about the generator. He wanted to teach me how to maintain it. I refused to learn, mostly out of spite.
A tear overspilled one eye and trickled down her cheek. She wiped it away absently.
I'd apologize to him now if I could. I admit he was right. I can't do that, can I?
Barbie knew a rhetorical question when he heard one. It was just the canister, he said. I can change it out.
Thank you,
she said, leading him to a patio table with an igloo cooler sitting beside it.
I was going to ask Henry Morrison to do it. And I was going to get more canisters of Burpees, too, but by the time I got down to the High Street this afternoon, Burpees was closed and Henry was out at Dinsmore's Field along with everyone else. Do you think I'll be able to get extra canisters tomorrow?
Maybe, Barbie said. In truth, he doubted it.
I heard about the little boy, she said. Gina Buffalino from next door came over and told me. I'm terribly sorry. Will he live?
I don't know. And because intuition told him honesty would be the most direct route to this woman's trust, provisional though that might be, he added, I don't think so.
No, she sighed and wiped at her eyes again. No, it sounded very bad.
She opened the igloo.
I have water and Diet Coke. That was the only soft drink I allowed Howie to have. Which do you prefer?
Water, ma'am. She opened two bottles of Poland Spring and they drank. She looked at him with her sadly curious eyes.
Julia told me you want a key to the town hall. I understand why you want it. I also understand why you don't want Jim Rennie to know.
He may have to. The situation's changed. You see, she held up her hand and shook her head. Barbie ceased.
Before you tell me that, I want you to tell me about the trouble you had with Junior and his friends.
Ma'am, didn't your husband?
Howie rarely talked about his cases, but this one he did talk about. It troubled him, I think. I want to see if your story matches his. If it does, we can talk about other matters. If it doesn't, I'll invite you to leave, although you may take your bottle of water with you.
Barbie pointed to the little red shed by the left corner of the house. That your Jenny?
Yes.
If I change out the canister while we talk, will you be able to hear me?
Yes.
And you want the whole deal, right?
Yes, indeed. And if you call me ma'am again, I may have to brain you.
The door of the little generator shed was held shut with a hook and eye of shiny brass. The man who had lived here until yesterday had taken care of his things, although it was a shame about that lone canister. Barbie decided that no matter how this conversation went, he would take it upon himself to try and get her a few more tomorrow. In the meantime, he told himself, tell her everything she wants to know about that night. But it would be easier to tell with his back turned. He didn't like saying the trouble had happened because Angie McCain had seen him as a slightly overage boy toy. Sunshine rule, he reminded himself, and told his tale. 10. What he remembered most clearly about last summer was the James McMurtry song that seemed to be playing everywhere, Talking at the Texaco, it was called. And the line he remembered most clearly was the one about how, in a small town, we all must know our place. When Angie started standing too close to him while he was cooking, or pressing a breast against his arm while she reached for something he could have gotten for her, the line recurred. He knew who her boyfriend was, and he knew that Frankie de Lesseps was part of the town's power structure, if only by virtue of his friendship with Big Jim Rennie's son. Dale Barbara, on the other hand, was little more than a drifter. In the Chester's Mill scheme of things, he had no place. One evening, she had reached around his hip and given his crotch a light squeeze. He reacted, and he saw by her mischievous grin that she'd felt him react.
You can have one back, if you want, she said.
They'd been in the kitchen and she'd twitched the hem of her skirt, a short one, up a little, giving him a quick glimpse of frilly pink underwear.
Fair's fair.
I'll pass, he said, and she stuck her tongue out at him. He'd seen similar hijinks in half a dozen restaurant kitchens, had even played along from time to time. It might have amounted to no more than a young girl's passing lech for an older and moderately good-looking co-worker. But then Angie and Frankie broke up. And one night when Barbie was dumping the swill in the dumpster out back after closing, she'd put a serious move on him. He turned around and she was there, slipping her arms around his shoulders and kissing him. At first he kissed her back. Angie unlocked one arm long enough to take his hand and put it on her left breast. That woke his brain up. It was good breast, young and firm. It was also trouble. She was trouble. He tried to pull back, and when she hung on one-handed, her nails now biting into the nape of his neck, and tried to thrust her hips against him, he pushed her away with a little more force than he had intended. She stumbled against the dumpster, glared at him, touched the seat of her jeans, and glared harder.
Thanks. Now I've got crap all over my pants.
You should know when to let go, he said mildly.
You liked it.
Maybe, he said, but I don't like you. And when he saw the hurt and anger deepen on her face, he added, I mean, I do, just not that way. But of course, people have a way of saying what they really mean when they're shaken up. 4 nights later, in Dippers, someone poured a glass of beer down the back of his shirt. He turned and saw Frankie de Lesseps.
Did you like that, Barbie?
If you did, I can do it again. It's $2 pitcher night. Of course, if you didn't, we can take it outside. I don't know what she's told you, but it's wrong, Barbie said. The jukebox had been playing not the McMurtry song, but that was what he heard in his head. We all must know our place. What she told me is she said no, and you went ahead and fucked her anyway. What do you outweigh her by, 100 pounds? That sounds like rape to me. I didn't. Knowing it was probably hopeless,
You want to go outside, motherfuck, or you too chicken? Too chicken, Barbie said. And to his surprise, Frankie went away. Barbie decided he'd had enough beer and music for one night, and was getting up to go when Frankie returned. This time, not with a glass, but a pitcher. Don't do that, Barbie said, but of course Frankie paid no attention. Splash, in the face, a Bud Light shower. Several people laughed and applauded drunkenly.
You can come out now and settle this, Frankie said, or I can wait.
Last call's coming, Barbie. Barbie went, realizing it was then or later, and believing that if he decked Frankie fast before a lot of people could see, that would end it. He could even apologize and repeat that he'd never been with Angie. He wouldn't add that Angie had been coming on to him, although he supposed a lot of people knew it. Certainly Rose and Anson did. Maybe, with a bloody nose to wake him up, Frankie would see what seemed so obvious to Barbie. This was the little twit's idea of payback. At first, it seemed that it might work out that way. Frankie stood flat-footed on the gravel, his shadow cast two different ways by the glare of the sodium lights at either end of the parking lot, his fists held up like John L. Sullivan. Mean, strong, and stupid. Just one more small-town brawler. Used to putting his opponents down with one big blow, then picking them up and hitting them a bunch of little ones until they cried uncle. He shuffled forward and uncorked his not-so-secret weapon, an uppercut Barbie avoided by the simple expedient of cocking his head slightly to one side. Barbie countered with a straight jab to the solar plexus. Frankie went down with a stunned expression on his face. "We don't have to," Barbie began, and that was when Junior Rennie hit him from behind, in the kidneys, probably with his hands laced together to make one big fist. Barbie stumbled forward. Carter Thibodeau was there to meet him, stepping from between two parked cars and throwing a roundhouse. It might have broken Barbie's jaw if it had connected, but Barbie got his arm up in time. That accounted for the worst of his bruises, still an unlovely yellow when he tried to leave town on Dome Day. He twisted to one side, understanding this had been a planned ambush, knowing he had to get out before someone was really hurt. Not necessarily him. He was willing to run, he wasn't proud. He got three steps before Melvin Searles tripped him up. Barbie sprawled in the gravel on his belly and the kicking started. He covered his head, but a squall of boot leather pounded his legs, ass, and arms. One caught him high in the ribcage, just before he managed to knee-scramble behind Stubby Norman's used furniture panel truck. His good sense left him then, and he stopped thinking about running away. He got up, faced them, then held out his hands to them, palms up and fingers wiggling. Beckoning. The slot he was standing in was narrow. They'd have to come one by one. Junior tried first. His enthusiasm was rewarded with a kick in the belly. Barbie was wearing Nikes rather than boots, but it was a hard kick, and Junior folded up beside the panel truck, woofing for breath. Frankie scrambled over him, and Barbie popped him twice in the face, stinging shots, but not quite hard enough to break anything. Good sense had begun to reassert itself. Gravel crunched. He turned in time to catch incoming from Thibodeau, who had cut behind him. The blow connected with his temple. Barbie saw stars.
Or maybe one was a comet, he told Brenda, opening the valves on the new gas canister.
Thibodeau moved in. Barbie pistoned a hard kick to his ankle, and Thibodeau's grin turned to a grimace. He dropped to one knee, looking like a football player holding the ball for a field goal attempt. Except ball holders usually don't clutch their ankles. Absurdly, Carter Thibodeau cried,
"Fucking dirty fighter!"
"Look who's top!" Barbie got that far before Melvin Searles locked an elbow around his throat. Barbie drove his own elbow back into Searles' midsection and heard the grunt of escaping air. Smelled it, too. Beer, cigarettes, Slim Jims. He was turning, knowing that Thibodeau would probably be on him again before he could fight his way entirely clear of the aisle between vehicles into which he had retreated, no longer caring. His face was throbbing, his ribs were throbbing, and he suddenly decided, it seemed quite reasonable, that he was going to put all four of them in the hospital. They could discuss what constituted dirty fighting and what did not as they signed each other's casts. That was when Chief Perkins, called by either Tommy or Willow Anderson, the roadhouse proprietors, drove into the parking lot with his jackpots lit and his headlights winking back and forth. The combatants were illuminated like actors on a stage.
Perkins hit the siren once. It blipped half a whoop and died. Then he got out, hitching his belt up over his considerable girth.
"Little early in the week for this, isn't it, fellas?"
To which Junior Rennie replied, 11. Brenda didn't need Barbie to tell her that. She'd heard it from Howie and hadn't been surprised. Even as a child, Big Jim's boy had been a fluent confabulator, especially when his self-interest was at stake.
To which he replied, "The cook started it. Am I right?"
"Yep." Barbie pushed the Jenny start button and it roared into life. He smiled at her, although he could feel a flush warming his cheeks. What he'd just told was not his favorite story, although he supposed he'd pick it over the one of the Jim in Fallujah any day.
"There you go. Lights, camera, action." "Thank you. How long will it last?"
"Only a couple of days, but this may be over by then."
"Or not. I suppose you know what saved you from a trip to the county lockup that night."
"Sure," Barbie said. "Your husband saw it happening, 4-on-1. It was kind of hard to miss.
Any other cop might not have seen it, even if it was right in front of his eyes. And it was just like Howie was on that night. George Frederick was supposed to have the duty, but he called him a stomach flu."
She paused.
"You might call it providence instead of luck."
"So I might," Barbie agreed.
"Would you like to come inside, Mr. Barbara?"
"Why don't we sit out here, if you don't mind? It's pleasant."
"Fine by me. The weather will turn cold soon enough." "Or will it?"
Barbie said he didn't know.
"When Howie got you all to the station, the Lessops told Howie that you raped Angie McCain. Isn't that how it went?"
"That was his first story. Then he said maybe it wasn't quite rape, but when she got scared and told me to stop, I wouldn't. That would make it rape in the second degree, I guess." She smiled briefly.
"Don't let any feminists hear you say there are degrees of rape."
"I guess I better not. Anyway, your husband put me in the interrogation room, which seems to be a broom closet when it's doing its day job." Brenda actually laughed. "Then hauled Angie in, sat her where she had to look me in the eye. Hell, we were almost rubbing elbows. It takes mental preparation to lie about something big, especially for a young person. I found that out in the army. Your husband knew it, too. Told her it would go to court. Explained the penalties for perjury. Long story short, she recanted. Said there'd been no intercourse, let alone rape."
"Howie had a motto. Reason before law. It was the basis for the way he handled things. It will not be the way Peter Randolph handles things. Partially because he's a foggy thinker, but mostly because he won't be able to handle Rennie. My husband could. Howie said that when news of your altercation got back to Mr. Rennie, he insisted that you be tried for something. He was furious. Did you know that?"
"No." But he wasn't surprised.
"Howie told Mr. Rennie that if any of it made it into court, he'd see that all of it made it into court, including the 4-on-1 in the parking lot. He added that a good defense attorney might even be able to get some of Frankie and Junior's high school escapades into the record. There were several, although nothing quite like what happened to you."
She shook her head.
"Junior Rennie was never a great kid, but he used to be relatively harmless. Over the last year or so, he's changed. Howie saw it and was troubled by it. I've discovered that Howie knew things about both the son and the father."
She trailed off. Barbie could see her debating whether or not to go on and deciding not to. She had learned discretion as the wife of a small-town police official, and it was a hard habit to unlearn.
"Howie advised you to leave town before Rennie found some other way to make trouble for you, didn't he? I imagine you got caught by this dome thing before you could do it."
"Yes to both. Can I have that Diet Coke now, Mrs. Perkins?"
"Call me Brenda, and I'll call you Barbie if that's what you go by. Please, help yourself to a soft drink."
Barbie did.
"You want a key to the fallout shelter so you can get the Geiger counter. I can and will help you there. But it sounded like you were saying Jim Rennie has to know. And with that idea, I have trouble. Maybe it's grief clouding my mind, but I don't understand why you'd want to get into any kind of headbutting contest with him. Big Jim freaks out when anybody challenges his authority, and you he doesn't like to begin with. Nor does he owe you any favors. If my husband was still chief, maybe the two of you could go see Rennie together. I would have rather enjoyed that, I think.
She leaned forward, looking at him earnestly from her dark-circled eyes. But Howie's gone, and you're apt to wind up in a cell instead of looking around for some mystery generator.
I know all that, but something new has been added. The Air Force is going to shoot a cruise missile at the dome tomorrow at 1300 hours.
Oh, my Jesus.
They've shot other missiles at it, but only to determine how high the barrier goes. Radar doesn't work. Those had dummy warheads. This one will have a very live one. A bunker buster. She paled visibly.
What part of our town are they going to shoot it at?
Point of impact will be where the dome cuts Little Bitch Road. Julia and I were out there just last night. It'll explode about 5 feet off the ground. Her mouth dropped open in an unladylike gape.
Not possible.
I'm afraid it is. They'll release it from a B-52, and it'll fly a pre-programmed course, I mean really programmed, down to every ridge and dip once it descends to target height. Those things are eerie. If it explodes and doesn't break through, it means everyone in town just gets a bad scare. It's going to sound like Armageddon. If it does break through, though... Her hand had gone to her throat.
How much damage? Bobby, we have no fire trucks.
I'm sure they'll have fire equipment standing by. As to how much damage... He shrugged. The whole area will have to be evacuated, that's for sure.
Is it wise? Is what they're planning wise?
It's a moot question, Mrs. Brenda. They've made their decision. But it gets worse, I'm afraid. And seeing her expression, for me, not the town, I've been promoted to colonel by presidential order. She rolled her eyes.
How nice for you.
I'm supposed to declare martial law and basically take over Chester's mill. Won't Jim Rennie enjoy hearing that? She surprised him by bursting into laughter, and Barbie surprised himself by joining her. You see my problem? The town doesn't have to know about me borrowing an old Geiger counter, but they do need to know about the bunker buster coming their way. Julia Shumway will spread the news if I don't, but the town fathers ought to hear it from me, because
I know why.
Thanks to the reddening sun, Brenda's face had lost its pallor, but she was rubbing her arms absently.
If you're to establish any authority here, which is what your superior wants you to do...
I guess Cox is more like my colleague now, Barbie said. She sighed.
Andrea Grinnell. We'll take this to her. Then we'll talk to Rennie and Andy Sanders together. At least we'll outnumber them. 3-2.
Rose's sister? Why?
You don't know she's the town's third selectman?
And when he shook his head,
don't look so chagrined. Many don't, although she's held the job for several years. She's usually little more than a rubber stamp for the two men, which means for Rennie, since Andy Sanders is a rubber stamp himself, and she has problems. But there's a core of toughness there, or was.
What problems? He thought she might keep that to herself, too, but she didn't.
Drug dependency. Pain pills. I don't know how bad it is.
And I suppose she gets her scripts filled at Sanders Pharmacy.
Yes, I know it's not a perfect solution, and you'll have to be very careful, but Jim Rennie may be forced by simple expediency to accept your input for a while. Your actual leadership...
She shook her head.
He'll wipe his bottom with any declaration of martial law, whether it's signed by the president or not.
She ceased. Her eyes were looking past him and widening. Mrs. Perkins, Brenda, what is it?
Oh, she said. Oh, my God.
Barbie turned to look and was stunned to silence himself. The sun was going down red, as it often did after warm, fair days, unsullied by late showers. But never in his life had he seen a sunset like this one. He had an idea. The only people who ever had were those in the vicinity of violent volcanic eruptions. No, he thought, not even them.
This is brand new. The declining sun wasn't a ball. It was a huge red bow tie shape with a burning circular center. The western sky was smeared as if with a thin film of blood that shaded to orange as it climbed. The horizon was almost invisible through that blurry glare.
God Christ. It's like trying to look through a dirty windshield when you're driving into the sun, she said.
And of course that was it. Only the dome was the windshield. It had begun to collect dust and pollen, pollutants as well. And it would get worse. We'll have to wash it, he thought, and visualized lines of volunteers with buckets and rags. Absurd. How were they going to wash it 40 feet up? Or 140? Or 1,000?
This has to end, she whispered. Call them and tell them to shoot the biggest missile they can and damn the consequences. Because this has to end.
Barbie said nothing. Wasn't sure he could have spoken even if he had something to say. That vast, dusty glare had stolen his words. It was like looking through a porthole into hell.